Okay, our guest for today is Ren Arcache Melvin, a.k.a. Bonnie.
Yes.
My wonderful friend who is the author of The Betrayed, which is in stores now. So I think you should stop listening right now and you should get a copy of The Betrayed and then, you know, come back. But anyway, hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Jessica. Thank you for having me.
Yes, and we're in a hotel with a nice view of the Pasig River, which has a particular significance to your life and to your novel.
To the novel.
Yes.
I grew up in Santa Ana overlooking the Pasig River at a time when there was a lot of stuff floating on the Pasig River. But also when I was a child, we used to smell the river, and the smell of the river is very much in the book. There's always water going through the book.
It's like when you say the smell of the Pasig River, I feel like holding my nose. So what did the Pasig River smell like?
It wasn't that bad yet, but there was definitely a smell. And as a child, I remember at night waking up and smelling that river. And there's a scene in the book where two lovers are together, mm-hmm. and they both grew up along the Pasig, but in different parts of Manila, mm-hmm. and they're both remembering that smell. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that also holds them together.
The smell of the Pasig River, which in this day and age
was a long time ago. And whenever it would flood, when I was a little girl, the river would flood every year. And then we used to sit inside, and we could still go fishing. We would go fishing inside my grandfather's house.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big part of...
Do you ever wish that someone would bottle the smell of the...
Oh, no! No, but I think I wish that I could bottle... the memory of that smell, the smell that I used to smell as a child, because mm-hmm. it's actually
Have you tried to describe the different components of the smell?
No.
Was there a smell of diesel or fish or...
No, there was like something vaguely rotting, but just vaguely rotting. But it was also dense. It was just a very dense smell that for me as a child was comforting.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the original title of the book, my working title, was Love and Water.
Yes.
Because there's so much about rivers and water in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key ideas in the book, and it's always bad for an author to talk about a key idea because the readers don't usually pick it up, is that, but it's stated explicitly that in human relationships, in love relationships between men and women, or men and men, women and women, they're underground rivers between people that connect them.
That's a lovely
one. And that is actually where the connection occurs, in this unspoken connection between people. And there's so much that we say or try to connect and speak about or touch or have sex. And if there's not that underground river really connecting people, then the rest of it doesn't work. The rest of it falls apart. What's essential is that flow and that movement, whether or not it smells, it often does smell, but that's what really flows, that goes from one to the other. So
I'm sure some people feel like their relationships are like the Pasig River before the cleanup. Yes,
yeah.
But your name is Ren Melvin.
Yes.
And when people meet you for the first time, they're like, what nationality are you? So you should be like a test case for what is Filipino. Because you identify as Filipino. But most people meeting you would think, she's French.
Yeah.
Well, she's American. She's...
It depends on how long they've known me.
Mm-hmm.
Those who've known me forever, like my classmates from when I was, you know, kindergarten and all that.
She's an assumptionista.
I'm an assumptionista.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously they don't treat me as a foreigner. The truth is, and again, this is another of my theories, it's like we're not human being, we're human seeing. I don't look Pinay, I'm white.
Yes.
So I look very foreign. I never thought of myself as not Filipina growing up.
Yeah.
Growing up, I didn't think of myself as not Filipina because there were mestizas, you know, there was Assumption, there was... My mother was Filipina. My grandmother was born in Silay. My great-grandmother was born in Pulupandan.
Yeah.
Great-great-grandparents were all on the maternal side, they were all from here. They were all from the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't as white as I was, you know, because my father's American, my mother married, so I turned out very, very white. But the mestizo crowd was Filipino mestizo. So they didn't think of themselves as foreign. And my father was the foreigner growing up. He was the foreigner.
The Americanski.
So, you know, when you can, I guess when you can point at somebody else, like the cook had to prepare special food for him because, I don't know if I should say this, but my mom used to tell the cook, for him you have to prepare walang lasa. You know, because otherwise...
Which is exactly what I think of American food.
It has to be walang lasa, then he'll like it.
If there's any lasa, they're afraid of it.
They're afraid,
and then, of course, they're afraid of things like fish heads and ice.
Yeah, of course, So I really felt growing up that I was mestiza, but absolutely Filipina.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't... Yeah, I didn't... Especially because there was like parang a real foreigner in the family who you had to translate everything to, and not just language but culture,
right?
You know, because culturally I really feel Filipino. And then I studied in a Filipino school. I didn't go to IS. I really, you know, and my mom went to Assumption, my grandmother went to Assumption.
Yes.
So, you know, what the shock came was when I moved abroad in my 20s, and and people would say, where are you from? And me stupidly, innocently would say, I'm Filipina.
Yes.
And then people would look at me and say, no, you're not. And it was like, ouch. I remember that. I remember that. Ouch.
Mm-hmm.
So what am I? Like, okay, then maybe you're American. You know, I have an American passport. So I lived 3 years in the States, and I pretty much couldn't relate at all to the culture. And all my friends were Filipino, Filipino or Latinos. You know, the Latinos were parang more. And then I went to France, and I'm definitely not French.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as soon as I speak, everybody says, where are you from? Also in the States, when I would speak, because I have an accent, people would say, where did you learn your English? So it's almost like every country I go to, people think I don't belong. And the one country where I do belong by birth, by maternal lines, by family, but not by looks, is the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And my heart is really here. I mean, I'm fed by the stories, by the literature, by the history, by all that. But I know I look like a foreigner. It's just something I have to live with.
Yeah, this is always a very interesting situation because I saw a Filipino-American movie called Bitter Melon, as in Ampalaya.
Yes.
And they look very Pinoy, as in they look like the people you'll meet on the street, they look super Pinoy. And then when they open their mouths, they have very pronounced American accent. So there's a kind of disconnect, and yet they're definitely Pinoy.
Yeah, and also, again, it's delicate because I haven't been trained well enough in the vocabulary of political correctness. So I hope you edit this out if I say it wrong.
Well,
but
I'm sorry that I'm going to get you into trouble because I don't know PC language either.
Yeah. But I also feel like, okay, I'll speak of France. I won't speak of America for the moment. But in France, if you say that a French person can only be white-skinned and descended from quote-unquote pure French, like a black person or a brown-skinned person cannot be French, that's the discourse of the far right.
Yes.
It's a far right racial discourse.
Right.
You know, like it's accepted by many that a countries now, given the shifts in populations, given the migrations, the economic, you know, the tidal shifts in what's happening in the world, countries are they're multi-ethnic.
Yes.
There's not... A country is not your blood and your race. And if you think it's blood and race, you can get into only Germans have to be Aryan, otherwise we
yes.
we eliminate them,
mm-hmm.
you know? The racial purity is a very, very dangerous concept. And yet that works. That doesn't work, I think, for somebody who's white-skinned in an Asian country because of all the colonial past and all the fight to get rid. Even though my family is not, they're not part of the ruling, you know, they're not, but still.
Yeah, particularly in the Philippines, it's not an issue because, you know, the whole country stops during Miss Universe and people named Pia Wurtzbach and Catriona Gray, you know, they're Tisay and, you know, they're totally... We are totally behind them.
Yeah, so. But they look more Pinay than me.
You
see what I mean?
Yes.
But give them one more generation, because I've seen how this works. Give them one more generation, and somebody who's 1/4 will not look anymore, usually will not look anymore Pinay.
Yeah, because some friends of mine met you at a dinner in Paris, and they said, "Ay, si Bonnie yung kamukha ni Diane Keaton."
Oh, yeah, always, always, always.
Which is a great name.
But that's it. So there's the feeling of how I feel inside, not even inside, how I feel and how I appear to others. And of course, we don't see what others see, right? If I'm looking at you, I see Jessica. I don't see Bonnie.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm most at home and happiest when I'm with people, I was going to say, from my home. But I don't see what an odd one out I am.
Mm.
And sometimes, I remember like when I did my MFA in the U.S., because of my writing, which is about the Philippines, because that's where I grew up. That's what formed me. So they didn't know what to do with me, you know, because they put me with the... They put me kind of with the minorities, you know. So I would be in a table with the mga Latinos, the blacks.
You, which brings up this whole this whole concept of why do you have to put people in the box?
Because that's what people do.
Yeah, well, especially in the publishing industry, for sure. Yeah.
And well, there are many reasons for that. You know, it's like claiming identity. I mean, there are many historical reasons for all of that. But it works in certain ways. Like, imagine, for example, a Filipino who's moved to the States, married another Filipino, and they have kids who are also Filipino-looking, and you tell these kids, you can't be American because you're brown-skinned.
Mm-hmm.
That's really racist.
Yeah.
But then again, I'm white, I'm from here, but it's different because I'm white, and... It's questions of power, it's questions of colonialism, and I really understand that also, mm-hmm. you know, I can't really say, you must pay attention, you know, you must give me a place, because it's, the power dynamics don't work that way, and understandably so.
And you wrote, I remember you wrote a lovely essay about these issues, and you called it the white cockroach.
Yeah.
Tell us again why the white cockroach.
Because Jean Rice... Where did she grow up? She grew up, and they used to call her the white cockroach, where that was her culture, that was her home, but the kids used to make fun of her and call her the white cockroach.
Mm.
And so, yeah, and she would often, you know, so in a way you have to leave to be with people who kind of look like you, even though there's no underground river. You know, you're just look on the surface, so you pass, but there's a deep sense of exile and loss.
Yeah, and one of the ways that Jean Rice tried to deal with this, it's like, okay, I am going to take Jane Eyre, and I'm going to write her backstory from the perspective of something I know.
Yeah. And she did that in her 60s, no?
Yeah.
I think she did in her 60s.
But she did write all these wonderful drunken wandering in Paris stories.
I know. And woman, like, half into prostitution.
She's finally getting her due, but
I think it was the surrealists who really liked her. And, you know, but it took a long while for that to happen.
Was she one of your favorites growing up?
Yeah, I really liked reading her. Her stories, the early books, are all kind of the same character, you know. But I really enjoyed reading her, and then I really, really loved the wild Sargasso Sea,
the backstory of Mr. Rochester.
Yeah, so.
You know, I never liked Jane Eyre because it's like she's going to marry that. It's like
Sayang,
she can
no?
do so Sayang, much better.
Sayang, that's really.
And, you know, when he's blind and broken down, and she can have him. Oh, please. Anyway, were you always a reader growing up?
Yeah, I was. I think like many writers, we read, you know. But I was very solitary and very shy as a child. So you know, my refuge was really reading. But I loved fairy tales, and I used to. I really loved fairy tales. And when I first started to write, I remember I was about 7 years old, And I had my grandfather's old typewriter, where you have to hit it so hard.
I love typewriters because, you know, it's a test of your conviction. I mean, if you want to write a sentence, you better pound those keys.
You pound it, but you had no choice at the time, diba?
Because now, you know, keyboards are so easy. It's like, and then you can erase. There's no commitment. With a typewriter, it's like you want to erase it, you have to go through the trouble of...
Yeah, and with the typewriter too, because it's slower and because, you know, you can't just erase, there's a slight gap between thinking and writing.
Correct.
So the sentences come out actually cleaner.
Yes.
Because you kind of have to think, you know, you can't just...
Yeah, it's the same reason that I prefer to write longhand.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it takes longer, so, you know, your mind goes to places it would not... go if you're facing a keyboard and, you know, you type so fast.
Yeah.
So, But, you know, we're probably from one of the last generations to...
Remember the typewriter.
To remember the typewriter and also to really love reading as a pastime, as something we do for pleasure.
Because
I worry about, you know, millennials and Gen Z, as in... They don't seem to be into reading anymore. They're into scrolling.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, it's like that fire fraud documentary I watched, where where they managed to fool thousands of millennials. It pointed out that with the social media generation, everyone is perpetually scrolling, and so everyone is competing for 3 seconds of your time. They want you to stop and just look at their post.
Yeah,
and then they'll start scrolling again.
I started to read, Laila Slimani, because I had heard her speak in Paris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the author of The Perfect Nanny.
Nanny and Adele, called Adele in English. In France, Adele came out first. It's a story of the nymphomaniac. And I didn't read that because, anyway, I didn't read it. But then The Perfect Nanny, it struck me because I had been very struck also by that. The incident on which it's based in New York.
Oh, it's based on
a true story of
where
a nanny,
the nanny
who murders
kills her charges. Yeah,
and I just really just started it last night, and I was so struck by how spare and strong and shocking the language is. And in a way, it's that 3 minute stop you in your tracks.
Mm-hmm.
But she's a very good writer, so it's not you know, she can do it. It's not just pure sensationalism or whatever. But it felt good to read a page that felt like a box in the stomach without taking away the aesthetic pleasure. Because I think the way I read now is definitely different. There are certain writers who can pull me in, but my attention span also, because I'm also on the screen, so my attention span, you know, I need it faster, I need it shorter.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't write a long book now. I think I want the next book, I want it to be very short chapters, just a completely different pace. And that's why I'm, you know, looking to see what other people have done.
Yeah. So your first book was a collection of short stories.
Yeah.
When did you write those short stories? A Normal Life, which is available from Ateneo University Press.
Yes.
You can find it on Shopee or Lazada. Oh. Yes.
Thank you, Jessica. I wrote those stories scattered over time, and they appeared in various reviews. And the way they appeared in reviews is sometimes I had lots of writer friends, editor friends, and, you know, they'd say, well, do you have something? You know, you just show it to your friends, and then they'd say, oh, you know, I like this, or whatever. So they appeared rather sporadically over time. And then one time, I remember it was at a bar in Malate somewhere, I was talking to Danton Remoto, and he said, those mga stories that are appearing, don't you have enough for a manuscript already? I said, I don't know, I would have to look, you know, because many stories I didn't even keep. And that's how it became a book. Thanks to Danton, I compiled it.
Life,
he said, I will look at it and I'll let you know when he liked it, and it became A Normal Life. So I was really, really happy with that.
And it has been translated into French.
It was translated.
Tell us the story of how it was translated and published in France.
I have a hard time, like, blowing my own horn, like many writers, I think. But what happened was that people who had read the book in Paris really liked it,
mm-hmm.
and somebody went to speak to somebody at the Village Voice bookstore, which was like the big English bookstore.
Which is now gone.
It's gone, sadly. But it was excellent. It was really like the center of like the Anglophone literary world with writers. So somebody I knew brought the book and talked to the book owner and said, look, this is a really good book, and what do you think if we do a reading here? And the woman loved the book. She called me. And so there was a reading that was very well attended. The book sold out, and she was very happy about that. So I got more copies. She stocked it. And she would recommend the book to people. And so what happened was that one day I got contacted via Ateneo, somebody who had picked up the book at the Village Voice on the recommendation of the bookseller,
mm-hmm.
saying, I love this book. I'd like to translate it and try to find an author.
Excellent.
It was like an English professor.
Mm-hmm.
So wonderful. And she did everything. She contacted. So I really didn't do anything. And it got good reviews. Mostly the reviews, France being France, focused on the stories that had some mention of martial law, dictator, trying to play
up
the political, the political angle. But good reviews, and I was happy about that. So,
Yeah, and I do miss the Village Voice. I remember you recommended it to me as the best English bookstore of its time, and because everyone says Shakespeare and Company, and when I think of Shakespeare and Company, I think of things like fleas. And
it's
dust.
It's slightly cleaner. It's like the passing.
Yeah,
the dust has gone underground.
Yes.
I mean, the dirt is under more. Less visible, but
yeah. But I remember the first time I stepped in, I was like, "What's this I'm smelling? It's dust."
But the new the daughter of George Whitman who took over. I mean, she's made it was really lovely under George Whitman, but it was kind of it was like really this venerable,
this charming
falling apart
place.
Yeah.
Yes,
and she, the daughter Sylvia, she's managed to keep the charm, but she's really spruced it. Up and things are in order now. You can find the books.
Yes, they're arranged alphabetically.
Yeah, and she has a very good program of readers who come in. She has wonderful people coming in, and sometimes some people give like little writing workshops upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And
readings. Yes.
Yeah, and readings.
Yeah.
Poetry readings.
Yes. Yes, because Bonnie tried to take me to a poetry reading, and I'm like, Bonnie, with poetry readings, I start snorting and then laughing out loud, so maybe not.
So, speaking of which,
mm-hmm.
That is something I love to read. Sorry, Jessica, poetry.
Yes.
I get really fed
by some
poetry. But not the poetry readings.
Depends on the reader. Because, some readers get really dramatic, so I start giggling. So a normal life. And then I remember your story of how... your scary neighbor turned out to be a famous book critic.
Yeah. There's this very respected newspaper called the Canard Enchaîné, the Chained Duck.
Chained Duck. Okay. That's how you know it's French.
And it was known for its independence and for it, it would break, it would have all these scoops, political scoops and all of that. And I think it has no advertising, and it's owned by the journalists. It's owned by the people who work there. I don't know to what extent.
Is it still around?
Fact check me. But
excellent.
It's very, very independent. And the very feared and frightening literary critic lived in my building in Montmartre. And we used to see all the books arrive and then all the books thrown away, but he would actually put it out in the hall because, everybody, all the publishers sent him. And
so the books that he threw out, you could pick up.
Yeah. I mean, he wouldn't throw it in the garbage
in the
month. He would put it, but it was all this stuff. And he was so gruff and big man and gruff and, didn't speak to anybody. And when my book came out in French, again, it's hard for me to do this, but I felt, oh my God. People were saying, well, just give it to him. So I rang the doorbell and it opened a crack. And this big, burly guy says, what do you want? And I said, I just had the book come out and I'd like to,
upstairs.
Can I just give it to you? And he just put out his hand and he took the book and he closed it. But like, at least I did it. I did it. My heart was pounding.
It's like when you give Hannibal Lecter his lunch. Yeah. It's like, do not approach. Do not say anything personal.
I have to say, I had a moment of like panic around that time.
And then
2 weeks later or so, I don't know exactly, but sometime later, there was this really wonderful review, you know?
Aww.
But really good. And he knew his stuff. He knew stuff about the Philippines. It wasn't just a super, and it was really a good review. And I was like shocked. And so I rang the doorbell timidly, and I said, thank you, that was really nice of you. And he said, it has nothing to do with being nice.
You know,
he said, I like the book, bang.
But you know, this is one of the things that makes me want to live in Paris. It's a city where book critics are considered powerful.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Very, very, very.
Even today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's the whole literary thing of Paris. I mean, when I arrived in Paris, there was this wonderful talk show called Apostrophe with Bernard Pivot, where he would invite writers and they would sit around a table and they would discuss each other's books. Extremely intelligent, wonderful.
Did it ever come to blows?
No, not that I know. But what got me was this was primetime television and one of the most widely, I mean, it had some of the best ratings, like these writers sitting around talking about books. So, yeah,
wow.
So that I really, there's that highly respected thing of book critics. Now, the other side of book criticism is that, you're useful to publishers and writers as long as you're a critic.
I guess the worst that can happen is you decide to write your own novel. Uh-oh.
Yes, absolutely.
Knives out.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then people don't answer your calls. I mean, you know, it's a usual thing.